Claire, welcome to SBS Radio's Armenian program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Claire, you wrote several books on the subject of Eureka. What attracts you to the period and the subject?
Well, I think I'm really interested in stories of that people who throw caution to the wind. I like risk takers and people who dream big dreams. And that's really something that you can say of the Gold Rush generation. They had huge ambitions. They wanted to change their lives. And I think that it's sort of almost difficult for us to imagine now this sort of opportunity to be able to go to another place. And in some ways, it's difficult to imagine. In another ways, we're seeing it all around us, and we still live in times where people are refugees, they're asylum seekers. They need to leave where they are, and they want to find a better life for themselves. And that's no different from the people in the Gold Rush. But there was this extraordinary pull, as well as the push away from their homelands. There was this incredible pull of gold, this allure of the possibilities of gold. So gold didn't just mean wealth. It symbolized a whole range of other things like independence and freedom and the ability to be your own master and no longer live in some form of slavery, whether that was an industrial slavery or, you know, some women would say that living in as a genteel English woman in a middle-class society was a form of slavery as well, and because they didn't actually have any autonomy over their lives. So it was this time where people were all brought together across the seas. They had to make huge journeys, 3-4 months it would take them to get from the old world to the new, where they really felt they could write their stories all over again. And that energy, that dynamism, I just find that really very compelling.
Claire, what were the main factors that led to the rebellion? Gold was discovered in 1851 and the Eureka Stockade rebellion happened in 1854. So what changes led to the bloodshed in a short few years?
Well, it was about the way in which the gold fields were actually run and regulated. So when people came, it was at the beginning, you know, it really was a rush, all right? It's really important to understand the pace of change. And so that in 1851, Victoria had a population of about 25,000. And a decade later, by 1861, that had ballooned to over 600,000. So when you think about that rapid kind of change, it's a society in flux. And the government was terrified about that. Prior to the gold rush, there was a very settled society in a sense of squatters who had taken the land, so the landed gentry, and then some people who were servicing the squatters essentially and lived in, you know, the small town of Melbourne. And then there were the Aboriginal people who had mostly already been displaced from their land by this time. So then there's this, you know, huge influx of people. And the government really needed to be able to regulate the gold fields. And one of the ways in which they were able to do that was to put a tax on mining. So they introduced a license fee. And it wasn't so much that people hated having to pay a tax to mine gold. What they hated was that essentially it was a poll tax. It was a tax on their presence, not on their labour. It wasn't about what they had earned. It wasn't an income tax, it was a head tax. And people really resented that. And they particularly resented it because it was a very heavy-handed means of collection. There was a military force on the goldfields, and the goldfields administration was in no way democratic, nor was the Victorian government democratic. So miners didn't have any say. They were paying this tax, but they had no representation in the parliament. They couldn't change any of these rules that were governing their lives because they didn't have a vote. Now, what changed very rapidly was that the ability to find gold in Ballarat had shifted by the late 1854. So all of the surface alluvial gold, basically the gold that was quite easy to get through the means of with a pan and a shovel, all of that gold had gone, and you had to dig very deep into the ground. It was this deep lead mining, they called it, in order to get gold in Ballarat, which was different in other places like Bendigo and the ovens in, up in the mountains. And but at Ballarat, you had to dig, and it could take up to 9 months before you may strike gold, or you may not. It was really all directed by luck. But over this period of time that you were digging, people were still paying their license fee. So essentially, the problem was poverty. Essentially, most people who were living in Ballarat were living in extreme poverty. And some lucky people were getting a bit of gold, and so there was the opportunity to see that people were able to purchase luxury goods and live well, but the majority of people weren't. And particularly, another factor is that these were families who were living on the Ballarat goldfields. You know, there's this myth that it was just men out there having a good time, but they were actually a lot of families. A third of the Ballarat population were women and children, and so these were families that were starving and women who were dying in childbirth in their tents because they couldn't afford to get a doctor. And the population were trying to tell the government this. They were trying to explain through constitutional means, through petitions, through deputations. They were trying to explain to the government that they were living in this situation of tyranny and oppression and poverty, and the government wasn't listening. And this is really what led, in the end, to the conflagration at Ballarat, because there ended up being a standoff between the miners and the government over this issue of the license fee.
So the license fee was only implemented in Ballarat because the rebellion didn't happen in other places?
No, the license fee was across the board, but this situation of it taking a long time to find gold, that was only in Ballarat. So the mining conditions were different in Ballarat. And in a sense, the population was different. There were more settled families who were living there as well. So it was a large population. It was the largest of the goldfields population. It was an unsettled and unhappy population. And they also had a particularly obnoxious administration in Ballarat as well. A particular commissioner Reed, who was a hothead himself and didn't handle the situation very well. And so it was a mixture of maladministration, of corruption in the goldfields administration, of deep unrest and unhappiness among the people there, and this political inability to do anything about it.
You just mentioned women and families, and you wrote a book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka Stockade Women. Any particular figure impressed you and like to mention?
Any particular women?
Yes.
Yeah, there were some extraordinary women on the goldfield. I write about a number of them who, you know, really stand out, but They were doing such a range of things. I mean, one woman was a woman called Sarah Hanmer, and she was running a theatre company on the goldfields. She was the manager and the owner of this theatre, and she was providing not only entertainment for the goldfields, but she was a very strong political character as well. And she, it turns out, was actually financing the diggers and in their license resistance movement. She was the one who provided the most funds to the Diggers Defence Fund, and so she was a real character. There was another woman called Clara Seacamp, who was the wife of the Ballarat Times editor, the journalist, and she worked as a journalist herself, and she in fact published some extraordinarily fiery and potentially seditious newspaper articles and leaders in that paper. Her husband was one of the ones arrested at the Eureka Stockade, and he was in fact the only one who went to jail, and she ran the newspaper in his absence. There were other miners' wives who were just as knee-deep in the politics, a woman like Anastasia Hayes. And so, I don't know, there are so many. They're really great stories, women who are very strong, able. They were mobilizing the diggers. Oh, another woman called Ellen Young, who was writing to the newspapers, who was really the kind of provided the intellectual leadership for the diggers movement. So all of these women have played their part, but have generally been written out of the history.
And what role migrants played in the rebellion?
Well, it's a migrant story. It's the gold rush is a migrant story. The Ballarat diggers were made up of people from all over the world. So there were a large contingent of Irish, and they're the ones who often get all the kind of publicity. But there were also Germans and French and Americans and people from all over the world had come to the goldfields, and the problems belonged to all of them. And that's why the diggers made their own flag, which we now call the Eureka flag, but at the time they called it the Australian flag. And they called it that because it was the symbol on it, which was the Southern Cross, was the constellation of stars that they all looked up and saw every night. It was the one thing that united them, from no matter where they had come from all over the world. The thing that united them was that they were all here in the Southern Hemisphere. They'd all made these incredibly journeys. They'd all crossed the equator, and here they were staring at this same constellation. And so that flag was called the Australian flag, and it was supposed to represent all of these different nations.
And do we know how they communicated with each other?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting question. I mean, we do know that they spoke in their own languages, and including those who we now consider to speak English, but I'm meaning the people who spoke Gaelic, Irish, Scots. They spoke in their own languages as well. They didn't just speak English to each other. So there seemed to be people who were able to speak across the boundaries of those things. There were Chinese, educated Chinese, who did speak English, who were there. So I guess you would say that English was the lingua franca, but all languages were definitely spoken. And one of the things that they did was that they hung out flags, so their national flags, so that if new migrant arrivals came to the goldfields, as they did every day, new people were arriving, they would be able to see the French flag or the Swiss flag, and they would be able to go and know that they would find their compatriots there.
Was there any reaction from the British government about the armed rebellion?
Well, it was the British military who were firing on innocent men, women and children. And the other thing to note is that women died in the stockade as well. And so they were fully aware of what was going on. All the messages were going back to the governor, and the governor was reporting back to England, who he represented. So the British knew exactly what was going on, but, you know, the British government perpetrated violence against civilians all around the world. There, it had only been less than 20 years since the Upper Canada rebellions, and you know, the British have a long history of putting down popular revolts.
And what is the prevailing opinion of the historians about the legacy of Eureka Stockade?
Historians will argue the toss about the Eureka Stockade until time immemorial, I think. On the one hand, people say, some historians would argue that Australia is the birthplace of Australian democracy, that the things that the miners were asking for, which included representative government, so that they wanted the rules changed so that miners could be represented in the parliament, they wanted a vote, that these things came about after Eureka. So some will say that Eureka was the trigger point, that it happened, and others will say, no, it was just the accelerator, that there were already moves afoot to change the constitution, to make it a more popular franchise, and that Eureka just hurried things up a bit. Others will say it didn't even do that, that these changes were already happening, and that it had really no effect whatsoever, and that it's an overblown, overhyped myth that Ballarat is the birthplace of Australian democracy. So there are a lot of contrasting views, just as there are contrasting views about how to interpret the symbolism of Eureka. And this is why the Eureka flag gets used both by the extreme left, you know, the communist youth movement was called Eureka League in the 60s and 50s and 60s. It's been used by the extreme left, but it's also now used by the extreme right, the Reclaim movement, who want to speak on behalf of what they consider to be, you know, the true blue Aussies. They use the Eureka flag also because they think that it symbolises independence, freedom, sovereignty, and you know their view is that that is the independence and sovereignty to be able to kick out people who you don't want to be in the country. The union movement has always used the Eureka flag as a way of symbolising a sense of independence and autonomy over the capitalist bosses. So there are many ways to interpret Eureka. It's kind of, you can take out of it what you want.
But the miners did have any illusion they can win or force change, or they were forced to rebel?
How it came about was that they decided to burn their licenses. They weren't being listened to by the government. They tried all of the means, to all the proper channels to go through, and they weren't being listened to. And so they decided, as a protest, to burn their licenses. And then the very next day after they held this protest meeting and they vowed to stand truly together to fight for their rights and liberties, the very next day the government ordered a license hunt. And what would happen if you were caught without a license was that you were fined £5, and if you couldn't pay that, which was a huge sum, then you were sent to jail. And the jails were already full of these miners who could not afford to pay the fine for not having a license. So en masse, they burnt their licenses, thinking, well, you know, if we stand together and we do this together, they'll have to listen to us. But as I say, the very next day, the government ordered a license hunt, and they ran into a community and they started shooting at people who were scattering, shooting at women, shooting at children, and looking for these unlicensed diggers. So at that point, the miners decided that they needed to defend themselves, and that's when they built the stockade. And they raised their own flag, the Eureka flag, at the stockade, and they called it a safe house, basically. They said any unlicensed digger could come there and that they would protect them with arms. So there's no evidence that they actually planned in any way to capture the government camp, to storm Parliament, to change the system in any way by force. They were protecting themselves against attack by the government, which happened very quickly. So they built that stockade on the Saturday, and on the Sunday morning at 3 a.m., the government forces stormed and took the stockade, killing at least 30, but probably a lot more. We'll never really know the number of people in the meantime. And so it was all over very quickly, but I would argue that there was never the intention of the miners to do anything but protect themselves.
Last question about the servant of Father Smyta, Johannes Gregorius. He's mentioned in timeline leading up to the rebellion. Is much known about him and why he was targeted by authorities?
No, not nearly enough is known about him. I think one of the problems is that most of the people who have done research on Eureka have been largely English-speaking. I would argue that there's probably a lot of archives out there that will tell us a lot more about Eureka if somebody starts looking for them in languages other than English, and in collections that are not in Australia, because, you know, people sent letters home from the goldfields, and if you start going looking for those letters or those diaries that people would have sent home to their own countries, and I think that there's going to be a lot more documentation there. So I would really encourage people to research some of the more culturally, ethnically diverse stories about Eureka. I don't think he was particularly targeted. He just happened to run into a bully, and one of the men who was a bully, and who was James Johnson, who was the assistant gold commissioner, and Gregorius was the servant of Patrick Smythe, and definitely the Catholics, the Irish Catholics on Eureka, were up to their necks in things, and so in some ways he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that he was targeted because he was Armenian. It may be more factual because he was lame, he had a slight disability, he might have been picked on for that because he was seen as being an easy target.
Claire, thank you for your time, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for your very interesting questions.